from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Christine Dudley, Democrat Peter Giangreco, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. A program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you ever missed the show and want to watch it on the web, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com. And again, we keep all of the broadcasts there for many, many years. So if you miss one, hop on and take a look at it online. We're going to be talking about, obviously, national politics. Rick Santorum dropping out this week has left a wide-open path for Mitt Romney, and it looks as though the engagement between Romney and the president has already taken place this week because of some things that were said by an advisor. An advisor, although she was appearing as a CNN commentator, but she's been a friend before, and her name is Hillary Rosen. And let's play what was said. We'll take you through the response, and then we'll begin our discussion. This was, again, Hillary Rosen. She was a CNN commentator, although she's been a Democratic advisor in the past.
Never to the Obama campaign.
But speaking as a CNN commentator, this is what she had to say that started a little brouhaha, as they say, this week. Let's take a look.
Economic well-being of their family and the like. But there's... But he doesn't connect on that issue either. What you have is Mitt Romney running around the country saying, well, you know, my wife tells me that what women really care about are economic issues. And when I listen to my wife, that's what I'm hearing. Guess what? His wife has actually never worked a day in her life. She's never really dealt with the kinds of economic issues that a majority of the women in this country are facing in terms of how do we feed our kids, how do we send them to school, and how do we worry, and why do we worry about their future?
Ann Romney had never worked a day in her life, or has worked a day in her life. That's what started the battle, and then the Romney campaign and Ann Romney returned fire with an appearance on Fox and also a Twitter from her in which she talked about the fact that she has raised five boys, and that in itself was a significant job, and she took offense by it. The Republican machine jumped on it. The Romney machine jumped on it. So let me begin, because at least two of our three guests here this evening have spent a lot of time involved in campaigns. Peter Giangreco is our card-carrying Democrat. Pete, always nice to have you with us on the show.
Great to be back.
I don't know whether you were watching CNN when Hillary said that, and she's not a friend of yours, and you made the point she's not been an advisor to the Obama campaign. But as a Democratic operative, had you been listening to that, what would have been your instant response?
Well, that was a dumb thing to say. And I think, you know, very clearly the Obama campaign very quickly denounced it. Jim Messina, the campaign manager, David Axelrod, even the president said it was something he didn't agree with. And, you know, personally, when this blew up, the first thing I thought about was when we had our first child, my wife developed an abscess, had to go back into the hospital, and I was left to tend to a newborn, and that was the hardest work of week of my life. So I don't know what Hillary Rosen was thinking about. She has kids of her own. She should have known better than to say something like that. But I think the interesting thing that sort of undid all this is there's a tape of Mitt Romney from January talking about, boasting about when he was governor of Massachusetts, that they got women who were receiving public aid to go back and get the dignity of work. So here he was saying to these women who are on public assistance, oh, staying home and raising your kids isn't work. You have to go out and get a job. So the reaction from the Romney campaign is a little overblown. And really, when you listen to Mitt Romney's own words about what he thinks about women in the workplace, you find it's just kind of a lot of bull.
So Peter, in his usual style, he has responded to the question, and then he's thrown some venom out there for the other side.
Well, some truth.
I want to now go to our card-carrying Republican. Again, Christine Dudley, you've been inside lots of campaigns. On the receiving end, if you were home listening to this, being an advisor to the Romney campaign, which you're not, but you are a Republican, what would have been your reaction when you heard the exact same thing?
Oh, my goodness.
opening.
No, seriously, I was not because Peter.
And the next words out of your mouth were, oh, that was dumb.
Exactly. You know, those of us, and thank you for having me on the show. It's always good to be back. And I've done this show for many years, and I'm sure I've said stupid things, and I know Pete has. But that being said, I went, oh, the narrative now is completely shifted over. I think the Romney campaign did the right thing. I think that the Obama campaign did the right thing in terms of the back and forth that ensued as a result of this conversation.
And we should also say that really why this is important, and you've heard me say this for umpteen years on this program, you know, the ultimate general election is decided by a very small, about 10% of the people, and they got to get about 5.1%. And when you are perceived to be insulting stay-at-home women, that's a very key. In many cases, that group could decide who the next president is.
I think in very
many
ways
it will.
So you've
got to move really quickly. Now, let me ask
Sean. But let me just say one last thing about what the Obama campaign did. They not only reacted quickly, but they also were utilized it very deftly to set up the firewall to say first ladies and spouses are off limits. Therefore, using that opportunity to firewall
as well.
Good idea. We got to bring Sean. Sean is our libertarian. He's our man in the middle. You're also sort of a master of new media. Talk about the important role that new media played in taking this issue, finding a mistake, and running with it very, very fast, and really dominating the news for 2 or 3 days.
Well, first I'll say that the Republican Party took the bus and backed it up and rolled it over her, and then took it and backed it up and rolled it over her.
Well, I think
again.
The Obama campaign was driving the bus that we were on.
And, well, I want to go back to your point about single mothers or stay-at-home mothers and different categories of mothers possibly driving this election. If you actually look at the swing states, you've got 30 million voters in our 7 or 8 swing states. You've got 5.6 million moms who are stay-at-home moms full-time. You've got another 9 million who are in the workforce some of the time and not in the workforce some of the time. And that's about 1.3 million or so stay-at-home moms in the swing states. If you look at how Obama beat McCain in the swing states in 2008, he beat them by a total of 835,000 votes. That's fewer votes than the number of stay-at-home moms that you have. And what's the biggest driving issue right now in this election that's being tossed around in the media? It's the fact that Romney is getting crushed by Obama in the polls when it comes to the women voters.
19 points down.
Well, and there's a reason for that, and it's because on economic issue after economic issue, Mitt Romney's on the wrong side. I mean, look, this is a guy who didn't even know who Lilly Ledbetter was. This was the first act signed by President Obama, which made it easier for women to get equal pay for equal work in the workplace. Mitt Romney didn't even know what it was. John McCain was opposed to it. The Republican Party over and over has stood in the way.
That's
economically.
Not his strength.
Can I ask a question?
Let me finish.
Okay.
Let me finish. Mitt Romney also wants to repeal the new health care law. In the new health care law, it says that insurance companies can no longer charge women up to 50% more for the exact same insurance they sell a man. That's the reason why Mitt Romney's getting creamed with women right now, is because over and over and over again, he is not leveling the playing field.
We're going to come back and talk about that. 1-800-723-8289. We'll hear from Chris and also Sean. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Chris Dudley, you had just heard a tirade from Peter Giangreco about Mitt Romney and why he is 19 points down to Barack Obama.
Tirade?
A diatribe.
It was a diatribe. It was a set
of
facts.
Now back to your assessment of why there's a 19-point gap.
Well, there is no doubt that there is a gender gap. And one of the things that I think that has not happened, because Romney camp has obviously been engaged in a pretty ferocious primary that is now ended for all practical purposes. And one of the things that now will become, we get into the phase right now, next 3 months.
Where you're bringing out the Etch-a-Sketch.
We're going to talk about, we get into the contrast phase. And those of us who do campaigns, you know, we're getting into contrast where Pete says what he says and I say what I say. And we base it all in fact and we take information. And one of the pieces of information that I found this week, which was very revealing or kind of interesting, and maybe Pete can address it, is when you talk about Lilly Ledbetter and fairness and equity and pay, something I really care about when
who
it comes
was
to
Lilly
women.
Ledbetter? Let's let the audience know. Peter.
Lilly Ledbetter was a woman who sued her employer because she was doing the same job as a man who was getting paid less for it. And so she became the symbol of the movement to strengthen the laws to make it easier for women to sue their employer.
And Obama, as a state senator in Illinois, sponsored the legislation.
No, president, the very first law as president that President Obama signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter
Act of 2009.
Okay.
It was
so
the first thing that we did because what it did was to make it clear to employers that they ran a larger risk if they decided to engage in this process, which happened for years and years and years.
And an analysis this week in the White House showed that women were still getting paid some 17 to 20% less than...
And you're talking about employees of the White House.
Yes, not necessarily within the same position, but the soundbite
stuck. That was
stuck.
The point of the law, is equal pay for equal work.
Yeah, but still, don't you think that there is some symbolic nature to that? If you're going to sign this historic piece of legislation, then, you know, to practice that same as an employer and understanding that jobs in the White House are different than perhaps other jobs. But I do think that that was kind of an interesting statistic, and I was a little taken aback by it, that 17%
I'm sure it was the
less.
Same. Bush White House.
Folks, back to my question.
About the same.
Why is Romney running 19 points behind? You were halfway through your answer. I want to get the whole
answer. I think
answer
that, here. Again, we are at the point in the campaign, and it is now time. The engagement took place this week. I got an email from the DCCC telling me that we now have the DNC telling me we now have an opponent, so it must be true, that Mitt Romney has to talk about the economy. He has to talk in very specific terms about lifting up his views on the economy, because the economy is the driving issue on this. And whether you're single mom, married, low income, middle income, high income, I think that is something that everybody's looking at, especially when they go to the gas tank,
okay,
especially when they're looking for a job.
Now, what is your answer to that same question, Sean? Why is there a 19-point gap?
I would start with the fact that in 2008 there was a 14-point gap between women between their voting for Obama and voting for McCain to begin with. So it really is only a few percentage points larger now. I do think that the economic factors are exacerbating it. I think that...
And he also had to run to the right in the primary.
Right.
Right.
It probably wouldn't have been so bad if Mitt Romney had the guts to stand up to the right wing who want to impose all kinds of things where politicians get to tell doctors and to perform unnecessary and invasive ultrasounds on women. Perhaps if Mitt Romney had the guts to stand up to the right wing in his party that want the government to be in your bedroom and in between you and your doctor, he wouldn't have this.
Well, doesn't that
do you believe I'm
I'm going to ask this
of everybody.
The fact that he wants
let me ask that question. As political commodities, I think most would agree, even if you don't like the president, you would view Michelle Obama as an asset.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Has this past week indicated to you that Ann Romney may be an equal asset, and should we see a lot more of her and hear a lot more?
I think that's already been established in the last few months of the campaign. In fact, when the governor was campaigning here in Illinois on Election Day and prior
she
to that,
made the
she has been doing the introduction. Yeah. She has a very compelling life story. She had breast cancer. She has MS. She raised 5 children. She is very much, just like the Obamas, very in sync with her husband and very much a partner with him. And I do think that
I think in many ways she'd be a better candidate than Mitt.
But
because
I think the last time I checked,
you know, she didn't put people out of work to make money. So, I mean, her life story is a little more compelling than Mitt's, which is sort of basically what what Santorum and others who said.
Well, her life story because they've been married for over 40-some years. So, Pete, you're married. You understand that. You know, it's a shared life story.
Right.
And it's a narrative on both of them. And she is an asset.
In the long run, Peter, let me ask the question. In the long term, because a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the misspeak or the appropriate speak, perhaps, but he shouldn't have said it, was what Mitt Romney's aide had said about the Etch-a-Sketch. When this is all over, it's Etch-a-Sketch, meaning
right.
that we don't believe everything that we're saying in the primary. We're going to change it before the general. Okay, so you had that slip of the tongue by a Romney person. Now you have Hillary Rosen, again, not representing the campaign, but certainly a left of center political commentator for CNN, saying something that gets everybody upset, or a lot of people upset, including the president, realizing there was political dynamite in what she had to say. 3 months from now, Sean Bennett, are either of these stories going to have some significant legs in how the campaign plays out? Is there a slogan to be had here?
I think that we need to back up and first look at the fact that Hillary Rosen is much more connected to Obama than most of us believe.
Yes.
Visited the White House 35 times, according to the logs, since he became president, 5 of which were personal meetings with Barack Obama. She is one of the chief lobbyists for the Recording Industry Association of America and all of their bills that are in Congress, including CISPA, to regulate the Internet and to regulate copyright acts. And also, she's a principal at the same PR firm that is representing Sandra Fluke,
who also has nothing to do with Obama. So I think everything you just said just pointed out that Hillary Rosen has no connection at all to the DNC or the Obama.
What did they talk about for 5 meetings?
She's a lobbyist for the recording industry. Under your
she was also president of HRC. She represented LBGT issues.
Under your definition, then the head of the Petroleum Institute is very close to the Obamas because he's been in there many more times than Hillary Rosen to lobby the president, and they are not exactly allies since the American Petroleum Institute is running millions of dollars of attack ads against the president. So everything you just said is just blather. And I think
the point is I'm going to let you make your point, but I got to ask my question first.
Sure.
I ask the questions, you make your point.
Okay.
Sometimes two or three times at the same time, over and over again, yeah. Over the theme music. Anyway, 3 months from now, is this flap going to have more political significance, whether it's a bumper sticker? Because to me, it's very reminiscent of Hillary Clinton in 92 with her Tammy Wynette, Stand By Your Man line.
Right, but
it rubs people the wrong way, and the Republicans would be foolish if they let her get away with it. And the intricacies of whether she's a lobbyist, the point is she's a left-wing Democrat who's on TV. She shot off her mouth. She said something was wrong. The president, they got out there with their mops to clean up after as quickly as they possible. That doesn't mean it can't be a bumper sticker and a wedge issue.
Let me tell you the reason why it's not. The Etch-a-Sketch moment was compliate Mitt Romney, a guy who tries to always cover up his past and to flip-flop and change
politicians.
I get to
news.
Make my point now, okay?
That's correct.
It is exactly who Mitt Romney is. There's nothing about what Hillary Rosen said who doesn't work for Obama and doesn't work for the DNC. There is nothing in what she says that reflects Obama, and that's why one will stick and the other one will not.
I disagree. Well, this is because
you
this
can
is
disagree all you want. About you just the don't have any good arguments.
This is
to make
about
it
the
fit.
Perception of what people are going to believe about women and their role in the workplace and their role in America.
Okay,
and,
do you know and anything about the president's relationship with his wife? And you think the president would have ever said this? No,
I would like to make my point now.
Could you at least acknowledge
Banks,
that?
Let's give him
I think that this does touch a nerve with Americans because of something which hasn't been really being connected in the media. It's that I think that the economic conditions, the banking procedures, the credit floats, all these things are kind of behind this mommy gate instance. I think if you pull moms across America, that many of them, if they were of the economic means to make the choice to be a stay-at-home mother, they may elect to do that. Some of them wouldn't. Some of them would want to work and be a mom at the same time. I think that what this gets at the crux of is that women feel like they're being sidelined in the political process, and they want their issues to be more.
But what, how
well, as the only Dudley, as the only woman
Christine
at the
Dudley.
Table,
couldn't connect it to Barack Obama.
Christine Dudley,
my point for me.
I think Christine Sean Dudley. Makes a point in terms of the larger construct, in terms of as he pointed out earlier. That middle ground in those in the 10 swing states and in the national I do think that there is a cacophony of women of the total moderate, liberal, Republican, Democrat. We still are at a disadvantage in terms of our voices. We still do not have equity in the political at the political table and at the policy table.
And
so I think that that is part of the frustration of all candidates. You know, I watched the news this morning, it still centers around white men for the most part.
Awesome.
And I think that is going to be a frustration that we're going to see more of. In all instances, it's going to come back to the question of the economy. And in all instances, it's going to come back to a comfortability. Currently, the president is well-liked.
We're moving to a break. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our outspoken Democrat tonight is Peter Giandreco. And Peter Giandreco is one of the country's leading Democratic political activist, a partner in the Chicago firm of the Strategy Group, and he also is celebrating a birthday in a few days, so happy birthday in advance.
Thank you.
And you want to share how old you are?
I'm 47, and I look great on radio.
47.
He does look great on radio.
Still look like you're 27. Also joining us this evening is the ever-popular Christine Dudley. She is a longtime political activist for the Republican Party, working not only in the Chicagoland area, hails from Indiana, where she's been involved in a lot of Indiana politics, and also did work in the state of Connecticut for the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign back in 1992. And Sean Bennett also joins us. He is our libertarian, not a member of the party, but he is by philosophy a libertarian. He's the chief executive officer of Bennett Arbitrage and also Zingle TV, which is a jingle company, and also he is an accomplished concert pianist, a prodigy, and your Facebook performance is the most downloaded concert piano performance in the history of the internet.
Well, on YouTube at one
YouTube,
point, yes.
On YouTube.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Very good.
How many views?
It had 1.2 million views in the first year.
Wow, that's pretty good. Amazing. Not the honey badger, but it was pretty damn good.
Let us go to the radio and the phones. Let's go to Mike listening to us on 89 WLS in Chicago. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a comment about the remark that was made about when Romney said that work-at-home moms, that Romney said he was going to put the dignity back at moms that were staying at home, that were on public aid.
Yeah.
Okay. How can you sit there and say that? That's a total spin on it, because work-at-home moms, usually they're financially stable. Okay, the family is financially stable. The mom stays at home, raises the kids. Okay, and you sat there and spun that totally wrong, because anyone that's on public aid, the mom and the dad aren't able to sit there and financially support the family. So if you and the Obama campaign want to sit there and, you know, clarify that, I'd like to see what the stats are on what the, you know, the income level of the total family is of stay-at-home moms. But Romney was totally correct. If the mom has to go back into the workforce and they're on public and the family is on public aid, then yeah, he is putting the dignity back into the women that have to go
back
to work.
The one point, sir, that you said that I would disagree with, and I'm going to let Pete answer for himself. When you talk about families on aid assistance to families, in many cases, in most cases, the father is not present. So it is a stay-at-home mom who is raising the children at that level.
I totally agree. I totally agree with you. What I'm saying is the way he presented that stat where Romney said he was going to put the dignity to the women who were stay-at-home moms.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, so you're seeing an example of why Peter Giandreco is so good at what he does, because he is a master of factual presentation.
Well, and I think
which favors the Democrats.
The caller actually missed my point, so maybe I wasn't as clear. So let me try it again. This whole brouhaha was whether staying at home and raising kids is work. And what Mitt Romney was saying is essentially, in saying that there's only dignity in working outside the home, is he was essentially
that's
saying
a mischaracterization. That's a blatant mischaracterization.
People can go.
Romney
hang on
said,
a second, Sean. Okay, you know this is a 3-on-1 breakaway. You got to let me have my time.
I'm the moderator.
Either staying at home and raising kids is dignified work or it isn't. Hillary Rosen said something that was very dumb and implied that it wasn't. Mitt Romney, they don't have to take my word for it. You can go look at the clip yourself. He said that work outside the home was dignified. The implication would be that work inside the home is not.
Here is the other implication of what was said, that she never worked. She shouldn't be talking about women's issues because she never worked a day in her life.
Right.
Now, the follow up on that was, you know, that mothers work and that's a big job.
Right.
And she came forward and said, I've raised 5 children. And then later on, obviously, I think most people know now she's overcome significant health issues.
Right.
But the other point that I think that she was making, which is out there, was never worked a day in her life. To me, that was the charge that reinforces what they've said about Mitt Romney. This guy was born with a golden spoon in his mouth. He's got so much money. She's raised out of money. She's never had to struggle because of an economic situation. Now, my question to you is, does that have the ability to play? Can Ann Romney relate? Now, granted, she's overcome cancer and multiple sclerosis. That makes her a heroine to many people in this country. But can she relate to the average person who's got, you know, maybe a couple of jobs, who is struggling just because of her economic upbringing? Is there some truth to what Hillary Rosen said about that?
Well, I think once we get into that type of conversation, yes, absolutely she can, because we get into this caste system otherwise, and this is America, not India. And, you know, Ann Romney did not come from financial means, and Mitt Romney built up a career and was very successful. We didn't castigate Eleanor Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s when they were people of means who went to the White House.
Kennedys and the Bouviers.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I think people, the success of the Romney team, if you will, and Mitt Romney's business success, doesn't take away from an ability, the success of Barack Obama in a very short period of time, rising up from the state legislature to the presidency of the United States. America likes winners. They like people who are achievers, and they
Sean
like people.
Sean Bennett, you had a comment.
So, yes, they can relate because they've been there.
A couple of comments. One is that I see this as an issue of choice. Ann Romney has said, you know, I chose to raise my 5 children and be a stay-at-home mom while I did that. Hillary Rosen adopted twins with her partner in 2001. In 2003, she took a leave from the Recording Industry of America lobbying duties to be a stay-at-home mom for a while. Then she broke up with her partner in 2006. She probably at this point doesn't have the luxury to not work while she raises her children.
Also coming back to a point, I just want to step in here for just a minute. Women, we talk about choices in women, and women primarily have been the caretakers in the family. I have tons of friends who might be of economic, they choose to have careers and children.
Right.
We shouldn't be painting with all these different brushes. Women, that's
but
part that just starts to irritate me.
And I think it
irritates women of the whole. Let's put everybody in a little box in a little basket and decide you get paid this much and you stay at home and you have this. And as women, we're still evolving, I suppose, and we still don't have equity and we still don't have equality. Having a firm economic bank account or opportunities
why
going to allow us that well, better.
I want to find out why are women still getting what 72 or 78%?
77.
Why are they getting 77%?
Single women apparently.
There was for years a huge education gap. And that
now
the income
now women are more educated.
Then the Democrats took over, and Nancy Pelosi was the speaker. And
yeah,
so why are things that way?
You've got all kinds of individual women of achievement.
Why did she not use her power? And when the Democrats controlled Congress, why did they not use their power to just change that? Why didn't they change that?
Because guess what, Bruce? And from a Democrat, I will say that there are limits to what government can do.
Oh my God! Stop the presses! You've heard it on YouTube and Facebook tomorrow.
Look, there was for years a structural education gap where men had more advanced degrees, and when you have more advanced degrees, you get paid more. Now, that has changed in the last few years, actually, in medical school and I think in law school you've had more women graduate than men. But it's going to take a while for that age cohort who are coming out now, who are 26 and 27 and 28, who are just becoming doctors and lawyers, for them to catch up and earn. And so I'm hopeful for my two daughters that this income disparity will change. But it, you know, getting back to what the campaign is about and Amnon Romney versus Michelle Obama, they're both going to have, like every candidate does, strengths and weaknesses. I think that Michelle Obama has the strength of being able to have been a mom who's juggled work and family. She hasn't overcome a health issue like Ann. So she's not as strong as maybe identifying with people as Ann
Romney.
But I
just agreed that they, when they said that she couldn't.
Let me just finish my point. Ann may not have the strengths that Michelle's had in her experience of balancing work and family, but she certainly has more strengths than the First Lady does in talking about overcoming health care issues. So everybody comes with strengths and weaknesses at the table from a campaign perspective.
I disagreed when the Obama camp, however, said that they couldn't afford to have Michelle Obama be a stay-at-home mom, which she would have possibly preferred at that point. That quote was out there this week. I mean, she was making $300,000 a year at the University of Chicago hospital system in her position, and he was making about $250,000 through royalties and lectureships and so on.
No. This was before I worked for the Obamas before he ran for the U.S. Senate. I'm here to tell you.
So pulling in a half million dollars a year, according to the released tax returns, is not sufficient.
You're fast forwarding to 2005. It wasn't long ago, 2002, 2003, where they were still paying off student loans. So when you're saying can't afford
Harvard,
Princeton?
Harvard and Princeton.
I mean, there were
student loans.
Student loans are student loans. You still have to pay them, right?
I know that.
I remember right at the end of the 2008 campaign in Iowa, the president was dead tired, and the two of them were talking about, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we were still paying off our student loans. And it was only two or three or four years before. And that's why people related to him, because they just sort of a little closer to the struggle that people go through right now.
When we come back, we're going to take more calls. 1-800-723-8289. Where do you come down on the battle last week over comments made about Ann Romney? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. In addition to the brouhaha over Ann Romney and Hillary Rosen last week, obviously a big political story in the campaign 2012 was the decision by Rick Santorum and his wife to suspend his campaign for President of the United States. Let's take a look at his farewell address.
The decision over the weekend that while this presidential race for us is over for me, and we will suspend our campaign effective today, we are not done fighting. We are going to continue to fight for those voices, fight for the Americans who stood up and gave us that air under our wings that allowed us to accomplish things that no political expert would have ever expected. A lot of greatness in this country. And we just need leaders who believe in that, who are willing to give voice to that, who are willing to raise us up instead of trying to provide for us and do for us what we can better do for ourselves.
That was Rick Santorum. He cited the health of his infant daughter, Bella, as one of the reasons why he decided to drop out. Coincidentally, there were polls suggesting that he was likely to lose his home state of Pennsylvania. Was this a convenient way for him to get out?
Well, I don't. In fact, we were talking off the air about, you know, personal lives of candidates, and we tend to put them in categories. And obviously, and I've actually read some things about. And she's not an infant; she's actually 3 years old, his daughter Bella. And the awareness that they've brought to the condition that she has with the Oscar chromosome. I think that is the human factor involved, but I do think the political factor is true. Pennsylvania was closing in on him. He had lost Pennsylvania in his last election by 16 points. It didn't
he had just
look
lost
like,
Wisconsin.
He had just lost.
Running out of money.
Won Illinois, you know, Wisconsin. So I think the political reality was there facing him, and convenient, you know, life is, as we've said earlier, full of choices. And when you have a 3 year old who is in distress and has that situation, I don't think it was a matter of convenience. I think the two coincided.
Yeah. Peter?
I think there was a clear pattern here that happened in all the big industrial states, which was Santorum would start with a lead. Romney and the super PAC would come in with millions and millions and millions of dollars in negative ads, and Romney would win. And I think Santorum saw that happening again. And I think that you can lose in Wisconsin and in Ohio and figure out ways to go on. But if you lose your home state, then that may be a more lasting thing. I mean, look, Rick Santorum was right in that clip. He pulled off something that no one would ever have guessed. If you looked at the whole field, there are very few people who would have said the one guy that's going to emerge to go one-on-one with Romney was going to be Santorum. Very few people would have picked that. And I think he is already playing for 2016.
I was just going to say.
There's no doubt about it that losing Pennsylvania would not have helped that. He is now – look, if Mitt Romney loses, and it's a big if, there's lots of time between
lots
now.
Lots of targeted swing states out there.
And lots of super PAC money on his side. So it's very possible that you might have a Republican in the White House. But in the – like. But if there's not, Rick Santorum might be the closest thing they have to a front runner.
Oh, I mean that is the history of the Republican Party in the recent times.
You're next,
and again in this particular case, you bow out, you avoid the potential embarrassment, you don't have the money, and again you have a personal situation that gives you sympathy. I'm not saying that it's not factual, but there's a natural sympathy that goes along with that. Sean, what's your take on just what Pete said, that Santorum conceivably could be the titular head of the party if Romney were to lose in November?
I do think that, just to back up just one step to get to that, there is that element of the sympathy situation which allows him a graceful exit weeks before the Pennsylvania primary. But I do think that he's looking forward to the future. I mean, let's consider that Romney outspent him on average 18-1 in the hotly contested primary states, and that he still managed to come within a few percentage points in several of those states. Right. There's another thing, though. A story emerged this week that Bella Santorum has recently been made a member of the NRA. Now,
it was in today's New York Times.
Now, why would he be doing that unless he's looking forward to the future? Why would you register somebody who has a chromosomal condition who may not make it to adulthood in the NRA unless he's saying, look, the fight's not over. I'm still going to play ball in this party. I'm going to be your conservative voice, et cetera, et cetera.
So he's using his daughter.
I don't know if I would say he's using his daughter, but I would say...
Well, if she's joining the NRA and she's 3 years old...
It shows that he still cares deeply about the issues relevant to the party. He hasn't just decided, okay, I'm going to go take a long vacation.
So because of what he said and the way he bowed out, should we automatically eliminate him from the Veep stakes?
I don't know. I mean, when you look at the Veep stakes, you know, this is going to be the greatest parlor game for the next 4 months. And there is a report that Ed Gillespie, who is now an advisor to the Romney campaign, was put in charge of doing the vetting and the choosing. And he said he didn't know anything about it. And I believe Ed. I know Ed very well. He's too Catholic and too honest to say anything that isn't true. But at the end of the day, no, I think everybody, I mean, all the also Rands have always been part of the sweepstakes. I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush is an indication of that. I don't think that this campaign, the Romney campaign, will go down that particular road. And to the point about...
But it would make it almost impossible, I would think, for him to now say, well, I can't, you know, I'm suspending my campaign, but all of a sudden...
Well, suspending campaign is only... That's a relative term. It's
that's
an FEC.
So,
it's,
that's just so he can collect the matching funds from the taxpayers.
And pay off whatever debts he... Right. he may have incurred. And also, as it relates to who's going to emerge, should, you know, as in the next generation of leadership, you know, this vice presidential sweepstakes becomes a very important piece of that, because the titular head of the party, traditionally, if when there's a sitting president, then, you know, the next step is to the vice president.
But Santorum, with his run, again, the surprises that Pete said, I mean, that was a phenomenal story of this year. And again, that's going to pay some residuals down the road. On that note, we have to say farewell to Peter Giangreco and to Sean Bennett and to Christine Dudley. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour talking about a variety of other things at 1-800-723-8289. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with our second hour of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Republican Christine Dudley, Democrat Peter Giangreco, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to continue our conversation of last hour, you may do so. 1-800-723-8289, or if there's a particular political issue that you would like to discuss. But however, I want to spend a little time talking about an issue that has just popped into the news, but is likely probably to dominate some news this coming week. The United States Secret Service, which has an impeccable image, almost a completely unblemished image throughout this country and around the world, yesterday placed 11 agents on administrative leave as the agency investigate allegations that some Secret Service men brought prostitutes to their hotel rooms in Cartagena, Colombia, this past week, and a dispute ensued with one of the women over payment the following morning. And the Secret Service director has said this has violated the service's zero-tolerance policy on personal conduct. It is likely to upstage President Obama's trip to that country. And this is a rapidly unfolding scandal, likely to upstage what is going to happen there. But, again, we have at least a couple of people around the table, I guess a third as well, who've had some experience either with the intelligence communities, protecting the president. You've certainly spent a lot of time around Secret Service people. Their image generally is impeccable, but they are human beings. And let's talk about the significance, if there is a significance, to this issue. Sean Bennett, you also have volunteered that you've had some experience in the intelligence community in the past. If you want to share that with us, you can. If not, I understand. But again, you come with some...
Yes, it was primarily a research capacity as a neuroscientist in
at Harvard.
The CIA. But the issue here is that if that prostitute was a member of Intel for a foreign nation, they could infiltrate and get information about classified plans for when the president was arriving, where he was staying, what his schedule was, where he was going, and on and on and on. It opens it to assassination attempts. It opens it to undermining the whole elite institution of the Secret Service, which so far to date has been largely unblemished.
Peter Giangreco, how significant is this story?
I think it's a significant story. I think, you know, the president spoke about it today. And clearly we have to wait to see what the investigation says. But this is beyond the pale. What the president said was basically, it's not just the Secret Service. Anybody who travels with the president represents the United States and has to live up to the highest standards. And it's very, very clear that these 11 members of the Secret Service, which, by the way, are not Democrats or Republicans or anything else,
no.
they're like the military to me, because these are folks who are literally willing to take a bullet for our commander-in-chief.
And there also is, by the way, five military personnel that are being investigated by the Defense Department, that they too may have violated laws, not necessarily these laws, but again, they're looking into it. Your response, Christine?
Well, I think it is a significant story, and it obviously is going to, you know, shift the conversation down in Cartagena for the president, because let's face it, it's sex and sex sells and people like to talk about it. That being said, the point being made about compromising the president and his security, and also the issue somebody raised this morning, and I didn't think about that, but I think it's true. I mean, we have a significant drug sex trafficking issue that is taking place around the world. Well, I happen to serve on Senator Mark Kirk's Women's Advisory Council here in Illinois, and that's one of the issues that he is having the advisory council. We've had members of the FBI in to talk to us, and I had no idea. I had no idea how profound it is in right here in Chicago. So the idea that, you know, these guys are idiots. Right. I mean, and really let's come back to the whole gender component here. These are 11 men who participated allegedly in this activity. Slap them upside the head. They're idiots, number one. But most importantly, they've compromised the president, and they've set a reputation, and I'm sure it's an isolated
it's really
situation because
it's really,
as you said, Pete and I and others, we've all worked with 30 years I've been around Secret Service, the best and the brightest.
Right.
By the way, typically on a foreign trip, more than 200 federal officials from the Secret Service, the Defense Department, and the White House staff are usually sent in 2 weeks in advance.
Wow.
Once the president arrives on Air Force One, usually with a support plane and a press charter plane in tow, an additional 200 people or more join the original group. So when you read and see that the president is flying around the world, this president or any president, think that there's about 400 people that are going with them. And to think that 11 of these allegedly did, and again, it appears over, you know, not wanting to pay a prostitute. I mean, it was bad enough that they hired prostitutes, but then they didn't want to pay them.
Yeah, is this a
budget cut or what?
Yeah. There's always this interesting interplay between the Secret Service and campaigns, and the Secret Service and the White House. Friction, I think, would be a good where it's not like the Secret Service works for and takes commands from the White House. In fact, you have this dueling friction because the Secret Service will say, oh, no, we're not going there because that is too dangerous for the president and the campaign pushing back.
You have to negotiate with
them.
There's
all these we're going to have a huge crowd. We're going to have 100,000 people in the stadium. Do we really have to put people through magnetometers? These are all – we went through this at the Democratic National Convention at the Invesco – I mean, we had
in Denver.
Yeah, I had 80,000 people in the crowd. They were all Democrats. So, like, we don't have, and the lines, people were passing out in line because.
But agents,
so you always have this friction between the campaigns and the Secret Service and the.
This is in an official capacity.
Exactly.
There shouldn't be any friction. I've never done a foreign trip,
yeah.
But you know that's pretty standard, especially when you're going into Cartagena, where it's not exactly without its difficulties as it relates to.
It's one of the most violent cities in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So you want everybody should be on their number one best behavior, and it's not like we're going to Great Britain and
By the way, there has not been any. As I understand, based on what I've read thus far, these were not necessarily involved in the presidential protection team.
No, they were not. There's a whole swath of people who come in and do various and sundry things in terms of communication, in terms of securing perimeters. I mean, there's just all kinds of pieces to this, and they were on the front, They were part of the team. I mean, irregardless, they were agents they were part of the team.
And historically, again, for some of our younger listeners, and I'm sure we have a few, one of the charges in the Kennedy assassination was that the Secret Service at that particular time had done some partying the night before. So there was some socializing that was going on. I don't mean that it was suggesting involving sex, but again, in the investigation of that assassination, there was some question as to how sharp they were on November 22nd of 1963. So I want to hear more about this. I also want to get reaction from our listeners. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8289. Sean, you wanted to make a further comment about the Secret Service.
I just want to commend the Obama administration for handling this the way that they did. They sent the 11 Secret Service members home before the Obama entourage got to Colombia. Mm-hmm. And it was just announced this afternoon that the U.S.-Colombian Free Trade Agreement is going through. So it may not have impacted the actual events of the conference in a manner that was detrimental after all.
But it upstaged it. Yes. Significantly upstaged it, and there'll be more talk about that than the specifics of the trade agreement.
Yes. Didn't compromise the policy objective, but it certainly is going to be on the front page of all the newspapers tomorrow.
It's static, is what it is.
Yeah.
It's just static.
And it's
noise. Nobody's going to remember it.
And
in a couple
of months, it's easy to talk about.
Right.
It's easy to talk about. It's, you know, it's not complicated.
Right.
It's in essence, it is, but it isn't because.
But your point was well taken too. This is not the president's detail. These are not the people surrounding the president, but they are.
They're never going to get promoted, I'll tell you that.
they're going to be looking for a new job, I think, is what they're going to be looking for.
Let me just say it again. They're idiots.
But it brings up, as you said, the potential for blackmail, even at that level.
Well, look, yeah.
I mean, if you're somewhere in the information chain and you conceivably could be compromised. And again, this is another reason why, you know, when you look at, again, historically, when you look at the relationship of John Kennedy and some of the things that he did while he was president of the United States, engaging in activities with someone who was very closely associated with the head of organized crime, Sam Giancana, and sharing a girlfriend and pillow talk and everything else, it is not, you know, I don't think it's a great stretch to say that that the security of the country could have been compromised by that pillow talk. And I don't think we can sugarcoat it.
No, but look, the only upside of this thing, and there's almost no upside to it, is, you know, a very bright line will be drawn, which, Sean, was to your point, since every intelligence outfit in the whole world, including, I'm sure, ours, do deploy assets like this to try to compromise men, mostly.
Mm-hmm. Why is that, Pete?
Well, because men are idiots. I will agree.
Okay,
with
I just
you,
want to
right?
make my point again.
I'm with you on this, sister.
You're somehow controlled by other elements, not necessarily the brain.
You know, it's a fact. So, but I think what it'll do. No one's ever going to be the second guy to make this mistake in the U.S. Secret Service. So it's bad. It tarnishes what was.
And hasn't there been some scandals in British intelligence?
Yes.
MI5 and
many of them.
Many. I mean, they're kind of, you know, novels have been. I mean, again, it's easy to talk about in terms of because it is sex. People want to chitty chat about it, but it does have deeper ramifications. But Pete, you're exactly right. It's static. If the policy Cartagena has not been compromised. But there will obviously be lots of people hanging by their toes reorganizing this.
The two oldest professions in the world have been brought together in this story.
That's true.
Prostitution and intelligence. Is that what you're saying?
And spies.
Well, yeah.
Spies.
We were saying off mic, who's the most famous spy of all time? Mata Hari.
You know? And for what reason?
I argued the spy that you never hear about. But but the issue here, it downplayed the other big goal of the conference, which was that these Central and South American countries wanted to push for U.S. to decriminalize the drug trade. Now, that doesn't look like it's going to get agreed upon. It looks like Obama's administration.
I would hope not.
That's dead
on arrival.
Bernard wants to bring that subject up. Bernard, listening to us on 89 WLS, listening in Evansville, Indiana. Go ahead.
Yes, I thought it was kind of interesting to read that that they're having so much trouble with violence in Colombia due to drug cartels, and that they had been asking for the United States, for the president to consider helping them with decriminalizing or doing something along the lines of changing the demand for some of these drugs that are fueling these cartels.
And is that something you support or are against?
Well, you know, that's a very complicated kind of problem. I understand the president of Mexico is also making the same kind of request. So it looks to me as though there's an awful lot of experience on the part of these two major players to suggest that they're not winning this war, and that that the demand from the United States is fueling a situation that could destabilize both these countries. I don't like the thought of that.
Well, the president doesn't either, so I think that's the end.
Yeah,
of that.
I don't think you're not gonna get any disagreement on either side of the aisle as it relates to that.
Can there be? Let us turn to the libertarian. Can there be a discussion of whether or not this is a good idea? It is certainly something that a progressive Democrat like Barack Obama, he could not propose it and get away with it. So it's going to come from some other source, and I think one of the most interesting and underreported stories of the last month is the fact that Pat Robertson has moved to the camp that favors decriminalization of certain drugs.
Yes.
In fact, I want to reach out to see.
Well, isn't that one of the main reasons that Ron Paul gets all the support he does on college campuses?
Well, that is correct. But I'm talking about this.
I would disagree with you that that's the primary reason he gets college support.
How do we as a nation, or can we as a nation, have a serious discussion?
I think that
we look
to the serious discussions that have occurred in EU countries. If you look at the EU over the last 10 to 15 years, you'll see the slow decriminalization of various classes of drugs for personal use, Portugal being the primary example, which has basically decriminalized all drugs, and they haven't seen an increase in use. They haven't seen they've seen a marked decrease in violence in some cases, although, you know, one would have to do an independent assessment of that to make sure it's not a biased reporting. I think that America is starting to have this conversation via other means, through medical bills being introduced in various states. They're not hitting it head on. Politicians know that it's a lightning rail, you know, and so they're letting state by state take this on. And the primary discussion in America, I think, on this issue right now is whether or not federal entities should be getting involved with state laws that are being passed that decriminalize.
Are you talking about medical marijuana in California?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And some
States? The whole issue of looking at whether or not it is a time to have this discussion.
Yeah.
Because obviously the decriminalization leads to a discussion of why we are the most incarcerated nation on earth.
And in Colombia.
And the costs involved in that.
Right. A $200 drug infraction can turn into $100,000 in prison costs very quickly. There's hundreds of thousands of people in jail, taking place in terms
of the incarceration and the inequity. And there is a lot of discussion because of the inequality of mostly African American men.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County board president here in Illinois, recently put some proposals forward as it related to incarceration, asking the state's attorney to lower this, not the standard. I don't know the legal term.
No, but it's allotted for first time nonviolent drug offenders. Saying, do we really need to throw all these kids in jail? Or is there a different way to deal with this? And I think that's a totally legitimate conversation.
But again,
something we gotta have.
But again, part of the reason, I mean, you quickly jumped early, both of you. The one thing you agreed instantly on tonight was that, you know, that there's not going to be a serious sort of discussion of that. And I'm wondering, can we ever have that serious discussion that says, okay, because it's taken a long time. I mean, there are some politicians, primarily African Americans from urban areas, that have talked about the difference, you know, the dichotomy of sentencing for crack cocaine versus other forms of cocaine.
Right.
And they put a racial element to it. And everybody says, oh, okay, the blacks are complaining about something again. So nobody gives it serious. But it has real practical life-affecting changes, and most importantly, it has a strong economic element to it.
And social.
But politicians, be they Republicans or Democrats, nobody wants to touch this because they don't want to be feared to say, "Oh my God, well I'm
soft,
you know,
on crime.
I'm soft."
Well,
on crime.
And we really,
but when Pat Robertson says it, that's news. That is a
well,
big
and I think Pete and I were just referring
and
to
chances are
some kind of conversation with Colombia. We have to have the conversation here in America.
This is
going to
hit judicially before it hits a legislative branch.
Well, I
there's
think
going
that's
to
right.
there and a lot of issues that are of a socially progressive nature tend to hit judicially before they hit legislatively.
Well, I think that's right. It's like civil unions.
It's very divisive to
right.
the voter base, but, and no one wants to run a campaign where they're taking a strong stance on something that is that divisive.
But there are practical things that are already happening now. You're having municipalities who are decriminalizing small possession crimes. You've got other people. And look, these are mainly state issues because, you know, there are federal minimums, and maybe we need to take a look at those, but that drive a lot of this on the sentencing side of it. But this is mostly a state
and that
issue.
Has to be looked at.
I think you can have a legitimate conversation about. But
it's in my view, it is wrong and it is fiscally unsound. And I think the same type of irate, in many cases, bipartisan approach that looked at the welfare system and said, you know what, this system is broken. It took decades and decades before Congress eventually did, you know, significantly changed under Bill Clinton the welfare reform system. And that's what has to be done now with the prison system, the incarceration of too many people in this country for crimes that could be handled and punished in less offensive and less costly ways.
Sure.
It's not being soft. It's being smart about crime.
Right.
We've got to be smart about crime, and we are not in this country, and we've got to
and
get
we're not talking about violence here. We're talking about, as Pete pointed
this
out,
this is different,
I mean,
than 20,000 people being killed in the cocaine trade
thoughtful,
in Colombia.
Thoughtful,
right. Exactly.
Punishment.
That's
back shortly from Chicago. From Austin, Texas to Arlington, Texas, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Around the table, our Republican is Christine Dudley. She's a longtime activist in Illinois and Indiana politics, also worked at the presidential level for President George Herbert Walker Bush in his campaign in 1992, and also very active in Republican National Committee activities as well over years. Peter Giangreco is here. He is partner in the Chicago office of the Strategy Group, and he is one of the country's leading Democratic strategists, and his area of expertise is direct mail, correct?
True.
Little opposition research and direct mail.
Well, those of us who work in campaigns can't live without opposition research, but it's not a speciality of ours.
But they direct, know how to utilize
but direct
it.
Mail is.
Yes, we do.
Direct
we
mail
do the
is.
Mail.
Okay. And also, and you are working in, which campaigns are you working in, just so that people listening around the country, some of these campaigns are
well known around the country.
We
are working for the reelect, but Tammy Baldwin for the U.S. Senate in Wisconsin, Amy Klobuchar is running for the reelection of the U.S. Senate in Minnesota, and Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton is running for governor in North Carolina.
Can you share with us what specific aspect of the reelect campaign, we've said direct mail, but is there a sub chapter of that you're focusing on?
No, last time I was inside the campaign and was the deputy director of polling and paid media. I am outside doing the creative this time. I've got a
partner.
Don't
you remember Hillary Clinton got really mad at Pete last time for some mail in Ohio?
Yes,
really mad at him.
Well, that's
my
okay.
client Ted Strickland was standing right behind her, which was interesting. Anyway. But yeah, that's
What was the piece that you did against Hillary that got Hillary very upset?
Why did you bring this up?
I don't know, because I've always, you know, she was waving it, and I was like, that's my friend Pete.
It was a little
is that the one where she said, come on, bring it on, Obama?
I think the words were, shame on you.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a little conversation we had about free trade agreements.
To our previous segment when we were talking
about NAFTA. It was the NAFTA piece, which was a huge story in Youngstown, where we, you know, is one of our big affiliates. So,
right, which was actually, as David Axelrod pointed out, the difference from 2008 Democratic campaigns to the 2012 Republican race. I mean, a couple of mail pieces, and I think like maybe one TV ad that we actually used Senator Clinton's name. That was it. I mean, this time they were ripping each other's faces off on TV in the Super PAC. So it was a very, very different campaign. And that was actually a lesson that the Obama campaign learned there, was we were too negative in that, and we never did that again.
Sean Bennett also joins us. He is the CEO of Bennett Arbitrage and Zingle TV, and also is an accomplished concert pianist. I want to go back to again, sort of what you do, because when you're in a campaign, obviously you have demonstrated here this evening that you can take any question and you can turn it into a direct attack.
Well, not any.
You're giving me too much credit. But you're a master of that. I mean, you're one of the very best who does that. And someone else who used to do that very well is now Rahm Emanuel, who's the mayor of the city of Chicago. As a way, he took his area of expertise was opposition research, and man, he could knock it out of the park. And you have those same skills. So my question to you is, when you're in a campaign against, let's look at Mitt Romney. When the strategy sessions take place, in many cases, maybe not too far from where we do this program, there's a long list of things that you and your Democratic colleagues feel are weak points in the Romney armor. How do you go about selecting which ones you're going to push? Do they all ultimately get pushed? And how do you go about crafting your message and making sure that that message gets to the right people, which, of course, is the beauty of direct mail?
That's a long question.
Yeah.
I have to give a very short answer to it. I mean, first of all, I think Pete
and I actually agree. We've had conversations. Operatives do what operatives do, and there's a, you know, we can sit down after an election. Well, we went here when you were going there.
Let's let them respond.
Well, I mean, generally you want to set up your greatest strengths against your opponent's biggest weaknesses. And so, I mean, that's really where and opposition research isn't anything but a collection of facts. It's publicly known information, voting records, statements people have made. There's a whole nefarious sort of cloak and dagger feel that commentators and people who write books all make it, but that's all it really is.
Yeah,
these are publicly available.
Well,
facts.
I think with the onset of the trackers,
the Google searches helped you.
I mean, look, and certainly that's how YouTube has changed politics forever. Mm. I mean, the most effective use of quote unquote opposition research, frankly, is when the candidate, your opponent, says something from their own lips. And certainly Mitt Romney over and over and over again in this campaign has said that corporations are people too, my friend, and on and on and on. You know, all of these things that he has come from his mouth kind of do the work for you. And that's usually where it works the best.
Likewise, for Mitt Romney, there are the promises that Barack Obama made 4 years ago, looking at the record in a variety of areas and seeing if he's delivered on that. That's how if we had a Republican comparable person here, they would be saying the same things.
If our economy doesn't get better in 3 years, I will be a one-term president. Mm.
And what do you say as someone who do you get direct mail? Do you end up with direct mail pieces?
Yes, I do. Yeah,
okay. From both sides. I mean, you're a libertarian.
From both sides.
Okay. What do you think when you receive that piece? What do you think they're obviously they're trying to get you to support that candidate? But can you? I mean, you're a very smart guy. Can you figure out the planning of why you got that piece?
I think that in particular, I get a lot of it, and I think it's possibly because they view me as an independent, somebody who may go either way in an election, or might be on the fence about a candidate, and may have voiced that in an event, a political event, or
well, but
something
the new evidence, and I do a lot of I consult on a lot of campaigns and work with things called micro targeting, and that's kind of the new.
What is that?
Micro targeting is just that, where you take consumer data and you overlay it with voter data,
right?
And you do polling, and you do all kinds of narrowing in to find that swing person and how you can effectively persuade them with, as Pete's business is called, persuasion mail.
Right.
You're there to persuade a candidate, a potential voter, one way or the other, and it usually doesn't take one piece of mail. It takes two or three pieces of mail on a similar subject with a similar theme, but you can get into that granular detail, and micro-targeting is used by both sides.
Right.
It's with the data components that they put on it, that you add to, and you can go in and slice and dice.
Is it generally could we say, generally speaking, that if people abhor television commercials, and everybody says they abhor negative commercials, but negative commercials obviously work, in the direct mail field, can you be dirtier? I mean, can you be tougher in direct
Absolutely.
Mail?
Absolutely. It's asynchronous.
What does that mean?
It means that you can read that piece of mail when you're in the mood to read that piece of mail. And it doesn't mean that you're a captive audience to the television commercial that you're sitting in front of right now.
Unless you TiVo it and zip
Right, unless
zip
you
past
TiVo
it.
It and zip past it. So you can get yourself into the frame of mind where looking at that piece of direct mail is going to be something that you actually want to be doing at that moment. You're going to be the most primed, to use a psychology term, for the perception of that piece of mail.
Peter, do you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, look, it's people consume it in so many different ways, and we've gotten to the points now where you know, we only target people who are who
vote.
Tell us, no, not just vote, but who are treatable in mail. There's some people who get it and don't read it and throw away, and they're not really treatable.
And that's part of the data points.
Right.
That's part of the data points when you're looking at micro-targeting. Will direct mail be an effective tool in this? And usually,
in a particular person.
It usually ends up being that you've got a television component, a mail component, and as you've asked, I mean, some you can put a lot more detail into the direct mail piece. The facts that Peter was discussing that come out of the Oppo, you can do the dot points. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot more information into a piece of mail that you don't put into a television advertising. But if you're doing it well, the advertising, it's all interconnected.
You have probably heard me, because you've all been guests on this show for a long time. Go back, you know, 20 plus years with Pete and with Christine. You've heard me say that, you know, campaigns generally, when you come out of a convention, each of the major candidates have about 45%. A campaign is about that 10%. Maybe it's even a little bit less. But if you get that 5.1, that's how you become president of the United States.
Yeah,
first of all, do you agree with that, Peter? And isn't direct mail, maybe even more so than television, isn't that the way you get to that 5.1% that makes you president?
Well, I mean, it's just a one tool. I mean, certainly social media has exploded as a tool to also communicate in a very micro way, and we've gotten even to the point now where
are there examples already in 2012 where social media, you believe, was the deciding factor in any campaign anywhere in the country?
Well, I mean, it's certainly been a deciding factor in these presidential races when Santorum won Iowa and the money that he was able to raise so quickly. I mean, that was certainly part of it. I think him getting to where he was, I'm interested to read the books afterwards to see what they did in Iowa on the Santorum side, because it was very much under the radar of a lot of the national press. I unfortunately didn't get to spend any time in Iowa. I'm interested to see.
Media never looks at mail. That always makes me, you know, media. There are very few people in the media who grab, you know, the piece of mail and want to do it. They want to put the TV ad on,
yes,
because that's
it's simple.
Again,
it moves.
It's sexy and it moves. Yeah. So you've got all of these pieces. And I think social media still hasn't penetrated down to the local campaign level. It's still kind of at the larger presidential. We saw social media being a very effective tool in the Marco Rubio race in Florida, where they really set the standard.
I want to talk more about that and also, again, the difference in analysis, and we'll do that when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. And Sean Bennett, you were making a point during the break about whether or not we can measure the success of tweeting and the new media in this campaign thus far.
Yes, and I mean, one example of that is that this whole Hillary Rosen thing played out with Ann Romney and Michelle Obama tweeting back their replies. But it's part of a larger set of points on social media. I think, honestly, if you look at the most persuasive elements in a campaign, probably the economy is first, probably the mainstream media is second, and probably third is a basket of different tools from direct mail to social media. However, if there's something that goes viral, there was an incredible viral meme this week, texts from Hillary. It was Hillary in sunglasses with her BlackBerry And people saying things like Obama saying, "Hey, Hillary, what are you doing?" And she'd say, "I'm running the world." And this was seen by 10 million people. If something comes
up. Now, are you talking Hillary Clinton?
Clinton.
Or,
Hillary Clinton.
Let's separate our Hillary.
Yes. If something comes up like that goes viral, it's on every Facebook wall, it's getting forwarded on Twitter as a picture, I think that that can disrupt its way up as high in the persuasive hierarchy as the economic issues, the 24/7
Well, it was clever and it was funny and it was it was entertaining. In as much as tweeting and social media is very profound in emerging democracies and in the Arab Spring, that wasn't clever and cute. That was a matter of life and death.
I would argue it's more than entertaining, because in order to go viral, I think that there has to be a fundamental element of truth to the underlying meme. So if
and
it touches
M-E-M-E.
A chord, M-E-M-E.
Does that stand for something?
It's a term from psychology that means an idea that has wings, essentially. Right. It's the corollary to a gene. Okay.
Yeah. And one of the other ones that happened, and this wasn't campaigns, it was certainly the Susan G. Komen misfire
Planned Parenthood. They're funding Planned Parenthood again.
They are, and they made an enormous mistake, but it did create it touched a lot of particularly younger women, which it was interesting the way it played out, because for years there have been people who have been involved in reproductive rights who said, gee, how are we going to reach these younger people, because they just don't believe that their fundamental reproductive rights are at stake. And when that happened and you had the Santorum and Romney campaigns going crazy and coming out for outlawing many common forms of birth control, you had these three things all happened at once, and these things were going viral online. And it really, really more politicized younger women. I'm saying women under 40. I can say that because I'm 47. You know, who are less political and frankly...
Well, there are communities that have been created
really
and
it just really felt like, wow,
right.
Wow, these are fundamental things. But, I never thought birth control was controversial, and all of a sudden this is going to be taken away from me. So it's not just the funny ha-ha things there has to be not only a kernel of truth, I agree with Sean with that, but there also has to either has to be really funny or something that really bothers you.
Sarah Silverman did one today. It was before and after pictures from a fake abortion.
Okay, that's lovely.
And
well, that's Sarah
and
that,
it,
that's,
it, that's it went, it, but it went viral, and the reason it went viral was because it has been such a fundamental issue in the political discourse for the last 6 weeks.
Is that likely to get legs, as we say?
I don't know that one is going to have the kind of influence that some of these viral memes
would. Back to the issue of social media in general. I mean, I talked in the first segment of the first hour about there isn't enough representation by women at the policy and political tables. And I have noticed that the communities that have been created that are not necessarily left or right, but they're communities of women having discussions about the political discourse and not on the social issues. I mean, they're popping up. I was looking at some today. There's Independent Women's Voices. It's got 35,000 people, and Kitchen Cabinet's got 60,000 people. And this is a community. These are communities that are being created, as Pete said, where younger people who don't take the time to potentially they move quick. They're always with the tweets and the texts and you know, there isn't a lot of context. I think they move so quick, but this is allowing to create communities. And we as political operatives, you know, I think we're still struggling with how do you harness that.
Right.
I mean, let's throw up a Facebook page. That's not always the answer to the question, because you've got to have a reason for people to want to go there and have a community discussion.
Sean?
Yes, I agree with you. There has to be some kernel of influence that brings the person to the page. Otherwise, there's not going to be any reason for that page to exist. It'll get zero hits. It'll get 10 hits over the course of a year.
Right. You said earlier in the program, you know, we're going to move into this period now where it's going to be all of a discussion about who's going to be running for vice president.
That's going to be the parlor game for a while, yeah.
So the question is, what role is social media going to play? It seems to me that has a... I mean, that's
point.
A wide
well,
open
I think
point
a lot
where people
of...
are going to be tweeting either positive things or negative things. People are going to be
well,
creating
sure
their own short
that'll
list.
Be that'll be the parlor game behind the parlor game. Mm-hmm. Will be the operatives who work for these potential VPs
and tracking them.
They try to either gin up or tamp down.
It may be the people who are placing bets on Intrade.
The real point is there going to be any organic
or against VP candidates.
Any organic discourse? Pete's exactly right. All the operatives are sitting in the room trying to figure out the recruitment strategy. Oh, we'll put up a Facebook page. We'll tweet. We'll do this, and we will pretend like it isn't us.
Quick question. a quick yes or no. In your view, has the power and influence of talk radio? Is it on the rise? Is it on the decline? Or is it about the same, Pete?
I would say that it will always be a force, but it's on the decline because it's been replaced by these other communities.
Sean. I'd say it's on the rise as long as it's streaming on the web at the same time.
I think it's about the same, but it definitely skews toward a 45-plus demographic.
We are out of time. Christine Dudley has been our Republican. Peter Giangreco has been our Democrat. Sean Bennett has been our Libertarian, and we thank you all for joining us this week. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman and Khalil Palil for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.